Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Informal Paranormal. This is Doug Kelly, and I am here on just helping out for the moment. I'm hoping that our host will be back. And I will keep you apprised of the situation. Tonight, we're going to have Robert Graves on talking about psychic dice. Sounds like an interesting program, and if you'll bear with me for a moment, we'll get everybody on. John, you there? Okay.
Yeah, Doug, can you hear me, Doug?
I can.
I'm having a real bad connection. I'm unable to really hear what you're saying. You're just barely coming through. I'm going to shut down and come back. Try and get in again, okay?
You give me 1 second. Let's find out if it's you or it's me. Let me ask the chat room. Am I coming over okay? So then it's not you, John. I'll let you know in just a second. I'm talking. Is that a good time filler, John?
I can barely hear you, Doug.
Okay, you can go ahead and do your thing.
All right.
Okay, so we will talk about things. I'm going to give you some updates on what's going on in Paranexus. Last week, we had Psychic Perspective with Michael Brooker and, of course, hosted by Gregory Kent. One thing I do want to mention, and hopefully it'll get out there a little bit, is that this coming Thursday night on Paranexus Universe, we have an awesome show scheduled. It's on near-death experiences research with Dr. Raymond Moody. Dr. Moody wrote the book, almost literally, on near-death experiences. He coined the phrase back in 1975. He wrote Life After Life. And he has recently written another book on shared death experiences, and he published that this year, called Glimpses of Eternity. Now, I recently read Life After Life, and I'm in the middle of reading the Glimpses of Eternity on the shared death experiences. And I've got to tell you, it's an amazing book. Both of them are amazing books. And you know, it's done so much for me in kind of getting me over that hump, so to speak, on really whether life exists after death. And I know that may sound strange. You know, I've kind of been on the fence a little bit, but I will tell you, in relating numerous experiences and examples of near-death experiences, that's one thing. These people all claim the same thing, regardless of upbringing or religious status or non-religious status. It's all the same type of elements that go into these near-death experiences. You know, they'll often see the tunnel, of course, the light. They'll have a life review that seems to happen fairly quickly, and they feel this incredible sense of love and acceptance and on and on. Well, the interesting thing that I hadn't known about was this thing called shared death experiences. And maybe you've heard about it, maybe you haven't, but I hadn't heard about it until I started reading this Glimpses of Eternity. And Dr. Moody talks about these shared death experiences where perhaps a loved one is dying and their family, their friends are in the hospital with them or wherever they're at. Usually it's in the hospital. And they'll be there in their last moments on Earth. And all of a sudden, the loved one who's there closest to them, in some cases several family members will experience this shared experience where the room will change it'll change form, and it's like they're projected into a different reality almost. In fact, on several occasions, there might be a spouse or a partner, something like that, that's with the dying person. And one of the things that many, many of them report that I hadn't heard before is this mist that seems to emanate from their chest area when at the moment of death. It's pretty fast. But even doctors have witnessed this, and other nurses and staff. I hadn't heard that before, but this seems to be fairly commonly reported with these shared death experiences. And then the loved one who's, you know, the spouse, the partner, the one who's not dying or hasn't died, will often find themselves along with this, the person who just died. They will be hovering above their body in an out-of-body experience along with the person that just died. And they're kind of participating in this life review. And it's fascinating because the person who's not dead, who didn't die, will learn things about the person or their spouse or partner, whoever, that they didn't know before.
I think I can get in there.
Oh, we got John back now?
Yeah, I'm here. And I'm here with Robert.
Ah, hey, Robert.
Hi.
How are you? This is Doug.
I'm doing fine. Interested in chatting with you guys tonight.
Yeah, sounds
well, Robert,
good.
We want to apologize. We had some technical difficulties on this end, and so Doug at the last minute heroically jumped into the fray. So, like, thank you there, Doug. So,
my pleasure. Let me just finish up one thing. If you're interested in near-death experiences and shared death experiences, please join us Thursday night at 9 Eastern, Dr. Raymond Moody on Paranexus Universe. Go ahead, John.
Okay, I'd like to introduce Robert Graves. He's the author of the book, The Art of Psychic Dice. And what we're going to talk about tonight is PK. And Robert wrote a very interesting book and basically explains PK in one of the most unique ways that I've ever seen it put to print, and that's within the context of a craps table at a casino. So, Robert, why don't you first of all say what your concept of what PK is for our listeners?
I kind of missed it. You asked me to say what my concept of PK is?
Yeah,
question?
Yes, please.
Okay. I want to try to go back in. I can't see the chat room right now. I was trying to get back into that. But, basically, most people, when they think they're going to read my book, think that what they're going to be able to do is absorb the information and then learn things about internally how to get their mind then to focus enough to move, begin moving objects around. And that's not quite what it's all about. Basically, PK is a brainwave, as all of the psychic issues are, one way or another. It's that our brains are doing something. We don't quite know what consciousness is, and somehow we connect between consciousness and the other side, the other world, the magical, metaphysical, spiritual realms. And this isn't about that. If you're interested in that, you might look up a guy named Hart, H-A-R-D-T, and he has some biofeedback systems that you can work with, and they'll deal with personal PK that in which you learn how to do that, you know, to point to things and move them around. The concept of my book is basically that if you have a little bit of PK and I have a little bit of PK, that we can merge them, that together we're much better. Two heads are better than one, three are better than two, and beyond that, 10 are better than three. And the book is about how to get that to happen, because I see that as the most effective for most people most of the time. And it applies not only at a craps table, like in my book, Art of Psychic Dice, but it applies to almost any intention that you're trying to accomplish. And that includes faith healing.
Okay. I'm assuming that when you're talking about this agreement, in your book, you refer to it as attaining agreement with people. Can you explain, go into more detail about that concept?
Well, yeah, there are a lot of things to say about agreement, but, to begin with, it's not just about agreement, but it's also about the emotions that go behind agreement. And that's where the whole thing really happens. I think the basic polemic begins with how complex an array our consciousness is. And I'm not trying to be this isn't like I'm a psychological expert in any way, but I think their mind is filled up with impulses of physical necessity. You know, you've got to eat, you've got to sleep, those kinds of things. You've got all your memories, you got all your senses, you got all your emotions at any given time, and you have all your thoughts. And at any moment, all of those can be inside your consciousness. So agreement begins, to begin with, within you in trying to get your whole self together in a way that makes sense. And with somebody else also, they all have all of those things going on at the same time. Hold on a second. I'm sorry. My another phone just went, is going off on me.
Hey, John.
Hey, Mike.
Sorry.
I finally made it. I finally kicked the internet mule and got her moving.
Okay.
Since we're taking a little bit of a distraction here, Robert, can you do me a favor? And can you go into your Skype tools and options and turn off the auto mic, you know, where it automatically controls your microphone?
How do I do that?
You're talking, you know, very passionately, which is great, but it keeps taking your volume real low. You go ahead and we'll see how it goes. So it's I don't want to do it on the air. So just go ahead and keep talking and maybe put your mic just above your mouth a little bit so it doesn't overamp it and drop your volume.
You mean am I too loud or too soft?
A little bit low.
Well, okay. That's about as close to my as I can get right there.
Try that. And I'll let you guys go.
And as I was trying to say basically before, is that I think the basic polemic is that we're really a complex array of all kinds of things, physical impulses, memories, senses, emotions, and thoughts. And the complexity of that isn't really understood, I think, by a lot of people. To begin with, if you could reduce everything that's going on inside of your head to just 10, you know, you've got 10 impulses, excuse me, all together, like 10 impulses, memories, senses, emotions, thoughts, that if you just get it all down to that instead of something else, even then, if you get two of those together at the same time to hit at the same time and be in agreement against everything else, you'd have, there are 511 different ways to do that. The point is that it's really complex. And even if you only have 10, if you could get it so that there are all the different ways that all those impulses can combine at once, there are 115,975 different ways to accomplish that or for that to happen. So it's a wonder almost anything psychokinetically ever gets done because we've got just so many things going on. So what we're trying to do is get it down to where inside yourself that can happen, you know, so that you can basically agree within that. And what I'm trying to do is get agreement first within yourself, but the same thing applies. If you're at a craft table or at a faith healing session, you know, you're there and you're with like 10 other people and only 10 people there. There are 511 different ways those people can divide up into two groups. You know, one and two are together, and the other eight are all together in opposition, or you've got three people together in the group of seven. 511 different ways that can happen. But you extend the exercise, there are 115,975 different ways that people can combine just as a group of 10. And so the idea is to cut through all of that somehow, is to basically get that to happen so that you can... You've got all the people wanting the same thing simultaneously, and that's what agreement is about. The main thing is that it has to happen emotionally. What you're trying to do is go for the deepest emotion that you possibly can. And I think it's interesting to bring in a couple of people who've worked on a lot of that. There's a gentleman named Greg Brayton, who's a personage within the BRAD, and he's a personage within the paranormal world. And one of the things that he did is went around and watched all kinds of intention masters, including Tibetan monks and Nepalese monks. And at one point he asked them, he said, look, I've watched you guys do these things. You go through all the prayers that you go through. You're moving objects around the room. And I've even seen faith healing and remissions. You got some of the cancer, and then a couple minutes the cancer is completely gone. And apparently they've got some of that on film also. And he said to these guys, what is it that you're doing? And the masters answered him, you know, when you see us do what we're doing, you're not seeing our prayers. What you see is us generating the emotions. And it's the emotion that is, in fact, the prayer. This I came across after I had my experience at a craft table and realized the same thing, but not quite that intensely and didn't have it backed up that way. And so I think that the first thing you're going to get, or the main things you're going to get in reading my book or talking about all of this, or if you're going to apply any of this in the future, that's what you're going for. You're looking for emotional agreement between people. And what I'm trying to do is find ways to do that. One of the best examples that I went through, was there a question there?
Yeah, well, actually, I was just wanted to clarify something with you.
Sure.
Now, are you talking about the same kind of energy that, like, when you've gone to, like, a, let's say, a sporting event, and the crowd is just totally, like, focused on the team, and they're with the team, and there's almost an energy that you can feel in that environment? Is that what you mean by the agreement that occurs?
That's exactly it. It's one of the first places it actually started to me. I had an older friend back in 1971 who started taking me to San Francisco Giants games and showing me how that works. And you often end up with people, you know, you've got one group of people on one side of a field, you've got another group of people on the other side of a field, and their heads are kind of together. And they're working with all that, trying to get their emotions to happen simultaneously. My friend, his name was Easy, demonstrated bouncing balls out of the park, hitting balls out of the park, and affecting different things that happen. So that's exactly it, and that's what's going on in there, except those people are sort of peripherally together in their emotions. They're not really all on the same page at the exact same moment with the same thought, if you will. And that's where that kind of thing misses when you begin dealing it with really macro macro formats. You know, you got George Norrie or Art Bell, who goes out there and he's affecting the weather. He's only a fraction of a fraction of a fraction as strong as it could be if people began working it more together. In other words, he had, you know, like instead of individuals in their houses, maybe a husband and a wife kind of agreeing that they wanted the same thing to happen, but instead emotionally agreeing about something, it would be much stronger. If he had 10 people together in a group and wanting the same thing to happen, and if that was happening in 100,000 different places, or if you had a couple hundred of them together, and the same thought went through what they were. Are we still there?
Yeah.
Okay. So
hey, Robert. Robert.
Yes.
Robert, let me interrupt a second. Yes. We're going to go ahead and take a 5-minute break, real quick, everybody, so we can get his microphone adjusted out, because we're just losing audio completely. So, Robert, if you'll just bear with us, and we'll. And stay on the line. We'll get you set up on that, and we'll be back, folks, in about 5 minutes. Okay, Robert, you there?
I'm here.
Okay, man, here's how to do it. You see where you called us on Skype?
Yeah, well, you called him.
I called him.
Okay. Oh, so this is on a cell phone?
No, I'm on Skype. I got an iPhone. I'm looking at my computer.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, if you look at the box that came up when he called you, at the top it says tools.
I've got maybe two John Rockies here. Let's see.
That'll be your main window, like a chat window. It really doesn't matter which one you pick. One of them, just pick tools and hit options.
Tools, okay. Tools, options, okay.
Okay.
Okay, go to audio settings.
Everybody can hear you anyway, so let's just get it done. Go ahead.
What's that sound?
Go ahead and go to audio settings.
Audio settings, okay. Click on it.
Yeah, you see where microphone is on the right-hand side?
Microphone is low. Okay. Yes, it's terribly low.
Well, see where it's checked off automatically? You adjust your mic.
Microphone volume.
Right below that bar. It should have a checkbox.
Okay, automatically adjust mic. Okay, hit it. And then move. How is that right there? Does that work, or do you need farther?
It's much better, but move your mic away from your mouth now.
Okay. How does that work? How is that?
It's more consistent anyway.
Yes.
Okay, I'm talking right now. Where would you like me to be at this point? Should I move the mic or try to get move the bar?
Turn your microphone. Phone volume down a little bit, Robert.
Turn the microphone
on the settings. Yeah.
Is that down far enough?
It's a little better. You'll have to just try it that way.
Okay, here's in between. How is this one right here? Does that work for you guys? I can't hear myself, actually.
That should work.
Right now, so that should work right there. Okay.
Let's go with that.
Yeah, let's go with that.
Okay.
Okay. You know, we were just talking about the macro implications, and I'd like to get back to that, but could we just switch over to micro for a minute? Just because I'm trying to wrap my head around what this means. And if I'm understanding it correctly.
Sure.
So, for instance, like, when you have, let's say you have a group of psychics, four psychics, right?
Okay, yes.
And they're all focusing on the same event or phenomena. And frequently they'll report that their abilities are magnified.
Yes.
Is that PK'd at the micro level?
Well, you know, when you're talking about PK, usually micro has to do with very small events, you know, extremely, I mean, just technically talking about it, or in the reading. The way we're, and so that means like, you know, doing things like at the, almost at the quantum level. And when you begin dealing with molecules and much larger, you know, tables moving, things like that, that's called the macro level. But with what we're talking about, we're speaking more loosely. And, I think when people are doing what they're doing, you have to judge what the result of it is. You know, it's so I was thinking of macro in terms of mass consciousness and a lot of people, you know, affecting dice or getting rain to go, like Art Bell is famous for doing. That's the kind of macro I was thinking about. Does that answer your question, or do you have something else?
No, I guess I was best. Where I was getting mixed up on in terms of the terminology between the micro and the macro.
Yeah.
I was envisioning micro as like a small group of people versus a stadium full of people. But that's not what it is. Okay.
Well, no, that is what it is. That's the way we were talking about it. That's why I was addressing. But there is confusion because if you read the literature, there's a difference in micro and macro in paranormal literature generally.
Okay.
In PK literature, especially.
Okay, so let me just ask you a question about the book, just in general. How did you end up picking, of all the various types of real-world environments, why did you pick a craps table?
Well, I didn't pick it. It's the world just evolved that way in my life. It's just, you know, things went that way. It's the larger story is I was in New Mexico in the Sagra de Cristo Mountains back in 1970, and I was at the top of a, I was out there with a commune and a bunch of people out in the woods, and some guy asked somebody to throw him something that was actually the cigarettes, and immediately the cigarettes, boom, came off the ground and flew into his hand, and that was my first look at, whoa, you know, this stuff is whoa. And beyond that same night, everybody else started shooting craps, and I just watched, and it was around that world that I kind of got introduced to it. Then we came back to San Francisco, and my older friends again took me up to a craps table, and I realized that, hey, there's magic going on here, because I hadn't been exposed to any of that kind of stuff before, and that's how it all began happening there. It was an area that I could go 24/7 and look at the paranormal, and I couldn't find any place else where that could happen, and that interested me.
Okay. All right. You know, in your book, at one point you were talking about basically the implication of how Western religion has impacted on the individual's PK ability or perception. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, what I think is what was interesting in the book, I was asking questions about prayer and looking at one of the big points I asked was what happened, you know, during the Inquisition. Was that actually Satan manifesting itself, or was there something else going on? Was it the church really trying to squelch anyone that had any paranormal abilities? And I've got a lot of thoughts about that whole thing. And since I've written the book, I have more time to think about it. And what I've realized is that there's nothing, is that first off, the issue with either Satanists or with the spiritualists, you're dealing with the paranormal people, they both have a similar idea that you're not supposed to use, you know, what we are spiritually for any kind of personal gain. And Satanists have it that any use of it or any contact with it is a real problem. But it doesn't make sense to me because nothing in the universe seems to work that way. I mean, spirit is inseparable from all the material world, and it's just we're hermetically sealed with spirit inside of us, and the other way around, spirit is hermetically sealed among us. You know, it goes both directions. Where, you know, the two things are inseparable. So I think that God doesn't want us really cut off from that. I think it's part of what we are in the universe, and he doesn't want us to move away from that any more than he would want us to move away from penicillin. It is possible. Go ahead.
Okay, so is it your belief that essentially, let's say, put it at the time of the Inquisition, that out of survival, we conditioned ourselves not to see spirits, not to be aware of PK, and basically distanced ourselves as a mechanism of not getting burned at the stake or stoned or some other type of church-related sanction?
You know, I'm not a historian. I was really asking questions in my book, but I seem to have this impulse that comes up on the side of me, and I don't know if it's something I'm making up, but to be honest, I think, and a lot of people might not like this answer, but I think we saw Islam coming, and I think we knew that we had to go into a scientific direction if we were going to be able to compete with it, and I think we began cutting ourselves off spiritually so it was a conscious decision, I think, on what we are as a group. But again, it's only an opinion, and stuff I can actually just be making up in my head, you know, filling in the blanks the way psychologists would tell us that we do. And I think that's part of what went on, but beyond that, it's not just that. I think there's a deeper problem with it in that I think most groups try to, most groups that deal with the magical, metaphysical, spiritual, try to pretend it's not there as a way of maintaining their power, basically. I mean, it's kind of interesting. Go ahead.
I would say I'd have to agree with that.
Well, I think there are fewer social sanctions. If you look on the internet, you're going to find all these people that are doing ghost hunting, and they're just all over the place. And I realize that's very interesting. And there are a lot fewer groups going with PK and telepathy development is trying to do it. And I think that one of the things that has happened is that if you go out there and you're hunting ghosts, I'm not trying to attack you guys, you're the only one that gets hurt. But if you develop yourself magically, metaphysically, spiritually, telepathically, in terms of PK, you really might challenge the prevailing structures of churches, cops, and the military, which are very, very strong, actually, when it comes to psychic stuff. But in the past, they've been the first to overtly deny it and pretend it doesn't there. And we've all got this, we kind of live this double life where we're all living with it, but at the same time, we've got the pretense that it's not there.
So to sum that up, you're suggesting that society sanctions us for the use of PK and other types of psychic or spiritual abilities?
I think they sanction it for people that are within their own groups. I think that, and then they try to hide it and keep it down for the most part. Keep everyone else not involved in it so they can maintain their own power.
Okay.
How do you prove that?
Well, I was going to say, if you remember the other night, John, when we were looking at grants on that government site and I searched for remote viewing, remember all the different government agencies that had bids up?
Yep. Well, that's true.
So, I mean, it's not that surprising, actually, that they try to keep it under wraps, but they want to totally control it to where society doesn't have any sense of freedom like they would, you know, like, I guess, another way of putting it, but yeah, I found that interesting. You know, you were saying that perhaps government and religious people know a little bit more than we do about potential ability.
Well, I think traditionally that was the case. I think after the 60s it changed, and in the sense that there were like four or five different things that happened through the 60s that influenced America. But one of them was the kind of spiritual revival, which has happened a number of times in American history. And I think that it woke up a lot of people. And it's one of the things that makes them so distrustful of, we deal with conspiracy theory stuff. It makes them so distrustful because they know it's there, they know it's at their fingertips, but they know they're not together. So I think that the difference is basically that when you're dealing with, I'm not against churches, I'm not against cops, I'm not against the military, but when you're dealing with them, they're organized and they understand, many of them, not all of them, many of them understand that they can, if they get their agreement together and if they do it with emotion, that they can have a profound effect on the world around them. And I think that's the thing, that so they keep it separate. They don't want 4, 5, 10, 15 people getting together to be able to project their own emotional feelings about how the world should be and to influence the world psychokinetically, telepathically, in terms of remote viewing.
Well, Robert, we have a question from the chat room. Catherine's asking, is there a way for a person to increase their own PK ability without joining together with others?
There was a woman, and I've forgotten her name. Her name was Parisi, I believe. I think it was P-A-R-I-S-I. I may have the spelling wrong, but if you look at that area. She did that on her own. She just was one of those people, which is not what my book's about. She went down in her basement, this is metaphorically, and locked herself in it and began looking at compasses, I believe, or toothpicks, and found that she had it because it was inside her. It was just part of what she was, and she was able to access that. You see, when you're dealing with it at that level, it's a brainwave. It's what each one of us is like putting out a little bit of PK, a little bit of telepathy. Some of us are putting out massive amounts of it, and we don't even know that we're doing it. And so she had that. She was connected. She had seen a Russian woman do it. And said, wait a minute, I'm not going to let the Russians, the Ruskies, get around us. She was in there, and she found out that she could do that. So you can find out if you have that. That's one way, and I'm not opposed to that at all. I just don't think it's ultimately your strongest way. But the other thing is, again, is that at the beginning of the show, I mentioned there's a gentleman named Hart, H-A-R-D-T. If you look him up on the web and put in psychokinesis or clairvoyance, one of those, you'll find he has an organization that's quite expensive. But what he's done is he's gone around and taken masters and recorded their brain waves. And then he's been able to juxtapose that somehow, or I suppose the wrong word. He's been able to infuse that with his biofeedback machine that makes those brain waves into a sound. And you lay down on the bed, light on the bed, and you listen to the sounds. And when you get your brain waves in sync with that, you're able to form the paranormal event that is assigned for. And there are different ones in there. One of the things he did is went over to the masters in Japan. And he talked to the Zen master and said, who are your best here? And they pointed to him and recorded their brainwaves. And he says, he claims, I haven't done this yet, it's about 15 grand, I think. But he says within a week, you can attain that level of what took them 30 to 40 years to do. So, yeah, there are ways to do it. This is not about that. But I would make this point even. If you're looking at artist psychic dice and you're using the concepts, if you've got one of those guys who's agreeing with you, in other words, he's got the ability to project that much psychokinetic energy, and you've got your amount, and you get him to agree with you, the two of you together are producing more than either one of you could.
That's what I say. It's like the old saying about 1 + 1 = 3.
That's right. So even if you are that's why I say that, and what I tell people, I would like the Pope to read my book like the Dalai Lama to read it, because even they would learn things and enjoy it, I believe. And if they didn't, they would at least enjoy it. But they can increase their output. And if nothing else, if you remember to focus this way, I don't know if you're involved in faith healing sessions or not, but the concepts out of the book definitely apply there. If you've got your aunt's over there and she's got a disease in her lungs, she's got the flu, if you want those 200 gazillion bugs to go away, you're each kind of like mourning and being separate, working separately. I think that if you consciously try to get an emotional agreement within your intention, that you're going to come out way ahead on it, and you're going to make yourselves all much more powerful, and that's the reason for going with these ideas.
Okay, Robert, when you talk about this type of healing, are you talking about energy work?
I haven't studied that enough, and I was just had a conversation a couple days ago, and I've got with a woman who is very much involved with Reiki, and I've read about it, and she liked my ideas also, and I liked listening to what happened with her. But yes, if you had, she actually agreed with me that when she went in and was not consciously doing it, but when she had a Reiki master do things with her, but then when she got connected, her head connected up, within all of that, yes, it was all much stronger. The feeling was stronger, and the outcomes were much better also. So it's all kind of the same thing. PK, whether you call it energy work, or whether you're hitting baseballs in a park, or shooting craps, or trying to get bugs to disintegrate, PK is really all the same stuff.
Okay, yeah, because, it seems like when I was reading your book, I'm going to use flashbacks, but I was like flashing to other areas of the paranormal world in terms of other types of concepts. And it was like, well, that applies there. And this, the way you were describing it was similar to another concept that another, you know, like an energy worker might describe. And I was, you know, I was intrigued with how it seemed to overlap and like just kind of flow into all these different areas.
What are you thinking of?
Well, particularly, you know, just in terms of like how when psychics get together as a group, they seem to have more oomph than when they're by themselves. So, you know, your concept of the agreement and the fact that, you know, four are more powerful than one. And the thing with like the energy work, because I've talked to people who do energy work, and it seems that sometimes when there's multiple people doing it at the same time, there's a sense that it all gets amped up as well. So it's an interesting phenomena. And again, you know, it's like, you know, you're touching on this whole concept of how people psychically can, you know, get together and increase their abilities.
You know, one of the places where that came home to me was there's a gentleman named Jack Houck, who's a he basically taught aircraft structure and worked in the space industry as a systems engineer. And he started putting together these spoon bending parties, and he's had over 300 or 400 of them all together. And I went to three of them, and this is just a guy that was I think probably all of you are familiar with Uri Geller.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He was the first spoonbender. Well, Hal started putting these parties together that they said, well, Geller can do it, we can do it. And he found the same thing, that when people work together, that it was always more powerful. And I was at three of those events and saw some pretty amazing things happen and learned some things. Basically starts out with focus, concentration, which has to do with using visualization exercises, which I think everybody in this audience would know about. But the thing that was interesting was that we all got these spoons in front of us, and we're all holding a spoon in front of us. Everybody starts yelling, bend, 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 bend. And you got a room of 30 to 50 people that are just, and it's like the silliest thing in the world to think about, but it's what we did. And then it was let it go. The idea was to, you know, back away from it and let it all happen. Because that's what also the most of the masters agreed to. Again, these weren't things that I understood until I really began focusing in there. But, I saw three different people take spoons, and they were working on the cupped part of the spoon. You've got the handle up, you got the cup part, and the cup part is really impossible to get in. I saw three different people at three sessions bend that cup part with their fingers. And I asked the gentleman, one of them, to give it back there. I had to give it back to him. They handed it to me, and I did. And I started trying to unbend it, you know, just to see how really tough this was, or if it was nonsense. And he grabbed it back out of my hand. But I realized for the moment that I had it that, you know, when you're working against a dome, you know, that's why domes are so strong, is because they're kind of coming from all different directions simultaneously. You can't bend them. And that's what a spoon is. It's a dome shape. And when you're doing that, it's very, very, very difficult to do. And by using these systems, that's what the agreement brought out. A lot of people to do something together. You know, in other words, that gentleman could not have bent that spoon by himself, except there were 10 people standing around him, you know, encouraging him, bend, 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 and we were all having fun with it. So I think there's another question.
Robert, I was going to say, is there a particular part of the book that you want to make sure that you get an opportunity to talk with our audience about that's particularly meaningful to you?
Well, I think it's all meaningful. It does reduce to some fairly, you know, simple things. Like one point about what we were just talking about there that makes it so powerful is that you never know whom you're standing next to. You might be talking to somebody, there are a couple concepts I have to explain first. First off, there's the whole idea that when young girls, for instance, are hitting puberty, and this comes out of one of the astronauts' books from 30 years ago, Psychic Explorations by Mitchell. He has an article in there that talks about, one of the things they found out is that when girls, young girls, are hitting puberty, they're often psychokinetic, poltergeist kind of things happening around them. There's also something called the spillover effect. So when you're next to somebody who is personally powerful that way, it spills over into you. And the point is that when you're at a faith-healing session or when you're trying to accomplish something, you never know who the person you're standing next to is, or and many times they don't know who they are. In other words, you can be at a craft table, stand next to a mother. Her daughter is 300 miles away, but the mother has the spillover effect, and the mother's PK is just hyped. and you never know when that's going to happen. So I think that's one of the important things. If we don't have a whole lot of time, the first point I would try to, you know, I reiterated a bunch of times, is as much agreement as you can, and you need to make it as emotional as you possibly can. And the big, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, no, you know, we're not running short on time yet. I just wanted to make sure you had an opportunity, if there was one part of that book that you wanted to make sure that the audience heard about tonight. I wanted to make sure you had that opportunity, because, you know, sometimes we get off onto a certain area and, you know, there we go. And then all of a sudden there's not, you know, you're thinking, oh, I wish I had said this, but that's all I was trying to cover with you.
Yeah, there is. Most of it is emotion, but I think that what the book spends a lot of time on and goes off into is that you've got to cut through it, to cut through all that mental clutter that I was talking about. You know, 115,975 ways 10 people can get forming groups against or with each other altogether. There are a couple ways to cut through it. Actually, the main way is one of the main ways is suggestion. And that one is the big one that we really haven't gone over into yet, is that you don't necessarily always have to deal with people's conscious minds. You know, you can also work on their subconscious when you're dealing with a group, and you've got, again, if you want to cure your aunt's viruses and whatever, you've got the flu or the pneumonia, you want to get it out of there. You can also use people's subconscious minds also, too. And one of the ways they do it at a craft table, you know, everybody looking there, you know, maybe 20, 30 people all together, and the guy will put the dice with the numbers that he wants up. And what he's doing is really suggesting to like 30 different people if that's what he wants to do. But you can use that also at any other kind of intention that you're trying to accomplish, within any other kind of intention. You can also use it at the faith healing session, you know, that you want to use. You can find ways to work it in. You can work it in conversationally. You can work it in through any other thing you can point to that suggests what it is you're trying to accomplish. You can kind of, and when you've got everybody doing that, they're kind of caught on to what they're doing, that they're reprogramming or programming to begin with each of their subconscious. That's a fantastic way to get everybody on the same page. I think there are two other major points. One is that fun precedes winning, and that's a huge one. Jack Howe's spoon bending session, we're all going, it seems absurd because you got these adult people, not children, you know, trying to look like they're out of the movie The Matrix, you know, where the spoon is all rubbery and bending, but we are, and it seems silly, but fun precedes it always does. So one of the things you want to look for is having as much fun as you can in it, keeping it as light and as, the thing is, you can get true belly laughs going. And as they're coming out of you, you kind of in your brain change it over to what it is you're trying to accomplish at the same time. You know, you've got this belly laugh happening in the middle of it, it's kind of like flowing between you and the other people out there. You simultaneously put in the thought that, we want Aunt Jean's viruses to go away. You know, something like that. That's hugely important.
Robert, can I ask you something? A number of times tonight you've mentioned faith healing, and you know, most people associate faith healing with an event that basically some divine force comes and intervenes, but that's not really what you're talking about, is it?
I personally see it both ways, but the people who are the masters of this, you know, the ones that have been interviewed by all the people that I've heard of, always talk about getting out of the way of it and letting the divine spirit come through them. And I'm talking about both, actually, because I think it happens both ways. I think that we're so bound up in the spiritual world that it's so much of a part of us that we can't get away from it, and we're projecting it, but there's also something much larger than we are. There's no doubt in my mind about that. I've had experiences that have just blown me away that aren't anything that I think humans could normally do. And given that, I think you can work both ways on that. And a quick point is I was one of the Jack Howe's experiences that I went to. We were out in Las Vegas, and it was a group of hypnotherapists we were working with. And one guy was standing next to me, and he had the spoon in front of him, and he was yelling at it, he was straining, and he was just going nuts with it. It was, and he couldn't get it to happen. He couldn't get anything to go on. But the fact was, he was getting upset because he couldn't do it. And what he was imbuing himself with was partly the fact that I'm not going to be able to do this. And all of his emotion was going there. every bit of emotion that he had was saying, I can't do this. And that's why, to some extent, you need to be able to let it go, as the masters talk about. To some extent, you're letting it go so that your own emotions aren't in your own way, your own sense of failure is in your own way, but also at times so that the high spirit, you know, the Holy Spirit can basically go through you.
All right.
I guess some of both.
Well, okay. I know from my own experiences practicing remote viewing that it seems like the times that I was the happiest and the most jovial were my most accurate readings. And, you know, that would play along with what you're talking about. You know, it has to do with good emotional energy. And it also has to do with not focusing directly on your target as far as the remote viewing is concerned, because, for instance, if you think, you know, longer than 3 seconds about something, your analytical brain kicks in and starts putting labels on it. And it just totally deactivates the entire process. So,
yeah,
I mean, what you're saying makes total sense.
Well, I wouldn't doubt that. I'm not certain as remote viewers you can sit around and yell, bend, 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 you know, or you get another word that goes in there and works like that. Although, you know, if you had a session maybe a few hours before where a group of you put out the intention and were, playing with the word intention or playing with something else so that you are all agreeing and viewing your own bodies with a sense of agreement, that's what you're going to do. I think you could maybe get it to work, but I think when you're remote viewing, you need a more calm state. But I'm not an expert on that. I would, I'm just guessing.
Actually, my best sessions when I had no distractions and no one around me. There's not necessarily a group. Now I've heard that groups actually perform better as far as having enough information to collate and actually get a better answer. But as far as the accuracy is concerned, it does seem that emotions have everything to do with it. So,
that's good to hear. Can you hype your emotions also, do you believe? Do you think you could do something by being loud and really trying to be funny also to make it happen? Or does that take you away from the that part of your brain that contains the Akashic record?
Well, for me, what I was experiencing the times that I was super accurate is I was so happy and emotionally just revved up that nothing was distracting me on thought level.
Interesting. Somehow you contacted something that just happened. That's good to hear. I would be looking for feedback in that direction, but I would also talk to the remote viewing masters. You know, you might want to look at Ingo Swan's work if you can find that as expensive. Or Joseph McMonagle also, you're probably already aware of. Yeah, you might try to find an email address for him or even mail him and ask him questions about that, how to get, you know, what that means and how to work with that. And I'll bet he would have 3 or 4 or 5 different examples to give you.
What I was alluding to, though, it does seem to have something to do with your emotional state. I mean, as far as what you've experienced, would you say that good emotions worked better than bad emotions as far as affecting things on a PK level?
You know, I think that it has to do with emotional intensity, but I'm personally, I like to identify with being ethical, and I think that with inside myself, because I'm set up that way, that you've got to keep it ethical, you've got to keep it honest, you've got to keep it as real as possible. But a couple of points about that, I think that if I was a sociopath, and I was with 10 other sociopaths who felt the same way, and they can hype their emotions that way, that the fact of the hype of the emotion would ultimately be their undoing, but in the short term, they could possibly be as strong as anything that that Mai and my group would be putting out. And then there's just the point I make in the book is that when I wrote the book, or I'd been writing it, one of our planes had just gone down had been hit by a Chinese plane. They landed on Chinese territory, and so you might bring that up to talk about at a craps table, because you know that everybody there is going to be for America and they're all going to be agreeing. And you're okay with that, because with that agreement you can maybe get some emotion, and that emotion then would make nice to what they want. The point is, though, that you look down at the end of the table and there are 9 guys standing there from the Chinese consulate, and their sense of what just went on is completely different. And so you can even be both right, not that we were both right, but you can deal with situations where there are shades and colors and there are different principles involved. And people have different ideas about inside themselves what is correct. But I think if you don't believe you're correct to begin with, that it's my sense that you would have a lot less PK coming out of you.
Hmm. Okay.
Hey, there's some questions in the chat room, and one of them is, Robert, do you think levitation is a form of PK?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely. Levitation is, PK has to do with any involvement with physical matter, you know, that's coming out of your consciousness. And so, sure, and there was the guy named Hume. His name was Hume from the 1880s. I would have to go back and look up his time. But there's one story about him being able to levitate. He was witnessed levitating out his window, out of building, and back into the window next to it, back into his room. And so some people have used their PK in that way and have developed it that way, or they were connected with some kind of PK force that worked that way. So definitely, yeah, PK is just another form of it. Excuse me, levitation is just another form of PK.
Okay. I know this isn't what you're advocating necessarily in your book, but there's some references to moving objects, questions related to that in the chat room.
And so I can't see the chat, so I'm glad you're asking.
Okay, so one of the things that people want to know is, I mean, do you have to, like, concentrate, you know, real hard in order to make something move, or are you, like, in a relaxed state? I mean, what's like, the mechanism? Is someone getting, in order to access your ability to use PK, are you, like, going into, like, that, you know, like, a meditative or a hypnotic state, or is it, like, you're getting incredibly focused? What's your take on it?
I think there's a number of ways to do it. One of them would be to be able to do that if you have that. If you're, the way your head is wired, the way your body and spirit are wired, you know, if you're more of a right brain person and the right brain deals with projecting that kind of PK, you know, it might require a quieting of your left brain of, you know, the logical part and getting into the emotional part of it and being able to do that. And so that could happen that way. But when I think of getting a group together, which I want to do, I kind of like to base it on, which I reference in Art of Psychic Dice also, is the Toronto Psychical Society. And these guys, therapists out of, well, psychologists, not maybe not therapists, out of Toronto 25, 30 years ago, wanted to find out if ghosts were real. And so they basically made up this idea that there was a ghost named Philip, and their book is called Conjuring of Philip. And they basically put a group together, 5, 6, 10 of them all together, I think, and tried to conjure Philip because they just wanted to find out what the truth was about ghosts. And it turned out they began coming in contact with something, but the problem was the Philip was a made-up story. It was just it wasn't real. And when they finished with it after about 2 years, they were able to conjure Philip, and it had a lot to do with singing and playing and carrying on that way. And it was a very seance kind of setting, but it wasn't quiet like the usual ones. And they were able to move objects across the room at will and move, bang their tables around. And it was even recorded, apparently, which I don't have, I've seen yet, and I don't have a copy of, but apparently they recorded on Toronto television at the time. So I think that you've got to look for your own way of doing it. You know, if you don't have it, and I don't have it in spades in my right brain either, I think a group and looking for emotional agreement is what you got to go for.
Okay. Robert, you know, we've been basically talking for the most part about, well, human PK. Do you think there's spirit PK?
You know, I was going to ask you about that because you seem to think that when we talked before that that's where it all comes from. And as I said before, I think that it there's some of both. I think we're so imbued with the magical, metaphysical, spiritual that it's just a part of us. You know, at the deepest levels, at the quantum level, and we can't separate it. And so I think that exists, but I also think it's quite likely that, and I've had some experiences with, this is going to get really strange, but I've had some experiences with what I consider to be potentially demonic, and I've had experiences with the gray. And when the gray finished, I ended up while I was at its height, I was going outside at 4 o'clock in the morning, and one to four street lights a week were going off all the time. Just had one go off not too long ago. And I'm not certain how all that works. You know, we don't really know what's going on with that. So, yeah, I think it's possible, but I don't think that it's absolute. Don't think it all comes from there.
Okay.
What do you think, by the way?
Well, I think that if you have spirit activity where things are being moved around and there's not a human agent, to me it stands to reason that if you have this intelligent energy, you know, because I don't know how else to define the spirit, but an intelligent energy, that they would have the same PK ability that we as humans, living humans, have, except all the breaks and all the, like, social nonsense that impedes us from our higher self and being able to access that level of our psychic abilities, you know, if that's no longer there, then why wouldn't they be able to do these things?
So you think, do you believe that we have some, or that everything that we do comes out of their realm?
No. I think that we have that ability as well.
Uh-huh.
But I think that we also have all kinds of socially imposed blinders, if you will, that get in the way of us, you know, easily accessing that, you know, ability and that information. You know, in other parts of the world, people are a lot more, familiar, if you will, with the spirit world. They're closer to it. You know, there's not that stigma. If someone sees a spirit in, you know, a lot of Asian countries, no one freaks out and says, wow, you know, are you off your meds or do we need to have a psychic camp? No, it's accepted, and there's not that stigma. Yet here, you know, it's changing now, but, I mean, in the not-too-distant past, if you went around saying that you believed in ghosts, you know, people were going to ridicule you, and, you know, possibly you might end up getting a psych exam out of the deal.
That's basically what it was when I first encountered this stuff in the early 70s, is that people I talked to were laughing at me a lot. And you could be afraid of somebody trying to institutionalize. I mean, literally with white coats and taking you away. I mean, one of the descriptions of schizophrenia is hearing voices. So that could happen. I also think of, is that it?
Well, we're running short, so wrap it up real quick.
Well, real quick is that the agreement doesn't necessarily have to be about what you want. If you want a number on a craft table with your aunt's problem to go away, the agreement doesn't have to be about that. It can be about anything, so long as underlying the whole thing is what you want.
Okay, and Robert, give us your website.
BartPsychicDice.com.
Okay, Robert. Well, thank you very much.
And thank you very much.
And we've enjoyed having you on the show.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you.
All right, Mike, so
yeah. That was a good show.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if I could get the internet mule going, it'd be all right. thanks, everybody, for showing up in the chat room tonight, and we'll have Paranexus Universe on Thursday as normal. And I guess that's going to be it for tonight. Anything else you want to add, John?
No, that's it, y'all. We'll see you next Sunday night at 10 o'clock on Informal Paranormal.
Thank you, gentlemen. Good night.